the ANU from California on a 2-year contract in 1989 and has been there ever since. When I visited her, in late 2001, she handed me a modestly hefty hunk of rock composed of thin, alternating stripes of white quartz and a grey-green material called clinopyroxene. The rock came from Achillea Island in Greenland, where unusually ancient rocks were found in 1997. The rocks are 3.85 billion years old and represent the oldest marine sediments ever found. We can't be certain that what you are holding once contained living organisms, because you'd have to pulverize it to find out, Bennett told me. But it comes from the same deposit where the oldest life was excavated, so it probably had life in it. Nor would you find actual fossilized microbes, however carefully you searched. Any simple organisms, alas, would have been baked away by the processes that turned ocean mud to stone. Instead, what we would see if we crunched up the rock and examined it microscopically would be the chemical residues that the organisms left behind, carbon isotopes, and a type of phosphate called apatite, which together provide strong evidence that the rock once contained colonies of living things. We can only guess what the organism might have looked like, Bennett said. It was probably about as basic as life can get, but it was life nonetheless. It lived, it propagated, and eventually it led to us. If you are into very old rocks, and Bennett indubitably is, the ANU has long been a prime place to be. This is largely thanks to the ingenuity of a man named Bill Compston, who is now retired, but in the 1970s built the world's first sensitive high-resolution ion microprobe, or SHRIMP, as it is more affectionately known from its initial letters. This is a machine that measures the decay rate of uranium in tiny minerals called zircons. Zircons appear in most rocks apart from basalts, and are extremely durable, surviving every natural process but subduction. Most of the Earth's crust has been slipped back into the oven at some point, but just occasionally, in Western Australia and Greenland, for example, geologists have found outcrops of rocks that have remained always at the surface. Compston's machine allowed such rocks to be dated with unparalleled precision. The prototype SHRIMP was built and machined in the Earth Science Department's own workshops, and looked like something that had been built from spare parts on a budget, but it worked great. On its first formal test in 1982, it dated the oldest thing ever found, a 4.3 billion-year-old rock from Western Australia. It caused quite a stir at the time, Bennett told me, to find something so important so quickly with brand new technology. She took me down the hall to see the current model, SHRIMP 2. It was a big, heavy piece of stainless steel apparatus, perhaps 12 feet long and 5 feet high, and as solidly built as a deep-sea probe. At a console in front of it, keeping an eye on ever-changing strings of figures on a screen, was a man named Bob from Canterbury University in New Zealand. He had been there since 4 a.m, he told me. SHRIMP 2 runs 24 hours a day. There's that many rocks to date. It was just after 9 a.m, and Bob had the machine till noon. Ask a pair of geochemists how something like this works, and they will start talking about isotopic abundances and ionization levels with an enthusiasm that is more endearing than fathomable. The upshot of it, however, was that the machine, by bombarding a sample of rock with streams of charged atoms, is able to detect subtle differences in the amounts of lead and uranium in the zircon samples, by which means the age of rocks can be accurately adduced. Bob told me that it takes about 17 minutes to read one zircon, and it is necessary to read dozens from each rock to make the data reliable. In practice, the process seemed to involve about the same level of scattered activity and about as much stimulation as a trip to a laundromat. Bob seemed very happy, however, but then people from New Zealand very generally do. The Earth Sciences compound was an odd combination of things, part offices, part labs, part machine shed. "We used to build everything here," Bennett said. "We even had our own glassblower, but he's retired. But we still have 2 full-time rock crushers." She caught my look of mild surprise. "We get through a lot of rocks, and they have to be very carefully prepared. You have to make sure there is no contamination from previous samples, no dust or anything. It's quite a meticulous process." She showed me the rock-crushing machines, which were indeed pristine, though the rock-crushers had apparently gone for coffee. Beside the machines were large boxes, containing rocks of all shapes and sizes. They do indeed get through a lot of rocks at the ANU. Back in Bennett's office, after our tour, I noticed, hanging on her wall, a poster giving an artist's colourfully imaginative interpretation of Earth as it might have looked 3.5 billion years ago, just when life was getting going, in the ancient period known to Earth science as the Archean. The poster showed an alien landscape of huge, very active volcanoes and a steamy, copper-coloured sea beneath a harsh red sky. Stromatolites, a kind of bacterial rock, filled the shallows in the foreground. It didn't look like a very promising place to create and nurture life. I asked her if the painting was accurate. Well, one school of thought says it was actually cool then because the sun was much weaker. I later learned that biologists, when they are feeling jocose, refer to this as the Chinese restaurant problem, because we had a dim sun. Without an atmosphere, ultraviolet rays from the sun, even from a weak sun, would have tended to break apart any incipient bonds made by molecules. And yet, right there, she tapped the stromatolites, you have organisms almost at the surface. It's a puzzle. So we don't know what the world was like back then. Hmm, she agreed thoughtfully. Either way, it doesn't seem very conducive to life. She nodded amiably. But there must have been something that suited life. Otherwise we wouldn't be here. It certainly wouldn't have suited us. If you were to step from a time machine into that ancient Archean world, you would very swiftly scamper back inside, for there was no more oxygen to breathe on Earth back then than there is on Mars today. It was also full of noxious vapours from hydrochloric and sulfuric acids, powerful enough to eat through clothing and blister skin. Nor would it have provided the clean and glowing vistas depicted in the poster in Victoria Bennett's office. The chemical stew that was the atmosphere then would have allowed little sunlight to reach the Earth's surface. What little you could see would be illumined only briefly by bright and frequent lightning flashes. In short, it was Earth, but an Earth we wouldn't recognize as our own. Anniversaries were few and far between in the Archean world. For 2 billion years, bacterial organisms were the only forms of life. They lived, they reproduced, they swarmed, but they didn't show any particular inclination to move on to another, more challenging level of existence. At some point in the first 1 billion years of life, cyanobacteria, or blue-green algae, learned to tap into a freely available resource, the hydrogen that exists in spectacular abundance in water. They absorbed water molecules, supped on the hydrogen, and released the oxygen as waste, and in so doing invented photosynthesis. As Margulis and Sagan note, photosynthesis is undoubtedly the most important single metabolic innovation in the history of life on the planet. And it was invented not by plants, but by bacteria. As cyanobacteria proliferated, the world began to fill with O2, to the consternation of those organisms that found it poisonous, which in those days was all of them. In an anaerobic or a non-oxygen-using world, oxygen is extremely poisonous. Our white cells actually use oxygen to kill invading bacteria. That oxygen is fundamentally toxic often comes as a surprise to those of us who find it so convivial to our well-being, but that is only because we have evolved to exploit it. To other things, it is a terror. It is what turns butter rancid and makes iron rust. Even we can tolerate it only up to a point. The oxygen level in our cells is only about a tenth the level found in the atmosphere. The new oxygen-using organisms had two advantages. Oxygen was a more efficient way to produce energy, and it vanquished competitor organisms. Some retreated into the oozy anaerobic world of bogs and lake bottoms. Others did likewise, but then later, much later, migrated to the digestive tracts of beings like you and me. Quite a number of these primeval entities are alive inside your body right now, helping to digest your food, but abhorring even the tiniest hint of O2. Untold numbers of others failed to adapt and died. The cyanobacteria were a runaway success. At first, the extra oxygen they produced didn't accumulate in the atmosphere, but combined with iron to form ferric oxides, which sank to the bottom of primitive seas. For millions of years, the world literally rusted. a phenomenon vividly recorded in the banded iron deposits that provide so much of the world's iron ore today. For many tens of millions of years, not a great deal more than this happened. If you went back to that early Proterozoic world, you wouldn't find many signs of promise for Earth's future life. Perhaps here and there in sheltered pools you'd encounter a film of living scum, or a coating of glossy greens and browns on shoreline rocks. But otherwise life remained invisible. But about 3.5 billion years ago, something more emphatic became apparent. Wherever the seas were shallow, visible structures began to appear. As they went through their chemical routines, the cyanobacteria became very slightly tacky, and that tackiness trapped microparticles of dust and sand, which became bound together to form slightly weird but solid structures, the stromatolites that were featured in the shallows of the poster on Victoria Bennett's office wall. Stromatolites came in various shapes and sizes. Sometimes they looked like enormous cauliflowers, sometimes like fluffy mattresses. Stromatolite comes from the Greek for mattress. Sometimes they came in the form of columns, rising tens of meters above the surface of the water, sometimes as high as 100 meters. In all their manifestations, they were a kind of living rock, and they represented the world's first cooperative venture, with some varieties of primitive organism living just at the surface, and others living just underneath, each taking advantage of conditions created by the other. The world had its first ecosystem. For many years, scientists knew about stromatolites from fossil formations. But in 1961, they got a real surprise, with the discovery of a community of living stromatolites at Shark Bay, on the remote northwest coast of Australia. This was most unexpected. So unexpected, in fact, that it was some years before scientists realized quite what they had found. Today, however, Shark Bay is a tourist attraction, or at least as much of a tourist attraction as a place hundreds of miles from anywhere much and dozens of miles from anywhere at all can ever be. Boardwalks have been built out into the bay so that visitors can stroll over the water to get a good look at the stromatolites, quietly respiring just beneath the surface. They are lusterless and grey and look, as I recorded in an earlier book, like very large cowpats. But it is a curiously giddying moment to find yourself staring at living remnants of Earth as it was 3.5 billion years ago. As Richard Forte has put it, this is truly time-travelling, and if the world were attuned to its real wonders, this sight would be as well known as the Pyramids of Giza. Although you'd never guess it, these dull rocks swarm with life, with an estimated, well, obviously estimated, 3 billion individual organisms on every square yard of rock. Sometimes, when you look carefully, you can see tiny strings of bubbles rising to the surface as they give up their oxygen. In 2 billion years, such tiny exertions raised the level of oxygen in Earth's atmosphere to 20%, preparing the way for the next, more complex chapter in life's history. It has been suggested that the cyanobacteria at Shark Bay are perhaps the slowest evolving organisms on Earth, and certainly now they are among the rarest. Having prepared the way for more complex life forms, they were then grazed out of existence nearly everywhere by the very organisms whose existence they had made possible. They exist at Shark Bay because the waters are too saline for the creatures that would normally feast on them. One reason life took so long to grow complex was that the world had to wait until the simpler organisms had oxygenated the atmosphere sufficiently. Animals could not summon up the energy to work, as Forte has put it. It took about 2 billion years, roughly 40% of Earth's history, for oxygen levels to reach more or less modern levels of concentration in the atmosphere. But once the stage was set, and apparently quite suddenly, an entirely new type of cell arose, one with a nucleus and other little bodies collectively called organelles, from a Greek word meaning little tools. The process is thought to have started when some blundering or adventuresome bacterium either invaded or was captured by some other bacterium, and it turned out that this suited them both. The captive bacterium became, it is thought, a mitochondrion. This mitochondrial invasion, or endosymbiotic event, as biologists like to term it, made complex life possible. In plants, a similar invasion produced chloroplasts, which enable plants to photosynthesize. Mitochondria manipulate oxygen in a way that liberates energy from foodstuffs. Without this niftily facilitating trick, life on Earth today would be nothing more than a sludge of simple microbes. Mitochondria are very tiny. You could pack a billion into the space occupied by a grain of sand, but also very hungry. Almost every nutriment you absorb goes to feeding them. We couldn't live for 2 minutes without them. Yet even after a billion years, mitochondria behave as if they think things might not work out between us. They maintain their own DNA. They reproduce at a different time from their host cell. They look like bacteria, divide like bacteria, and sometimes respond to antibiotics in the same way bacteria do. In short, they keep their bags packed. They don't even speak the same genetic language as the cell in which they live. It is like having a stranger in your house, but one who's been there for a billion years. The new type of cell is known as a eukaryote, meaning truly nucleated, as contrasted with the old type, which is known as a prokaryote, pre-nucleated, and it seems to have arrived suddenly in the fossil record. The oldest eukaryotes yet known, called Gripenia, were discovered in iron sediments in Michigan in 1992. Such fossils have been found just once, and then no more are known for 500 million years. Compared with the new eukaryotes, the old prokaryotes were little more than bags of chemicals, in the words of the geologist Stephen Drury. Eukaryotes were bigger, eventually as much as 10,000 times bigger than their simpler cousins, and carried as much as 1,000 times more DNA. Gradually, a system evolved in which life was dominated by two types of form, organisms that expel oxygen, like plants, and those that take it in, you and me. Single-celled eukaryotes were once called protozoa, pre-animals, but that term is increasingly disdained. Today, the common term for them is protists. Compared with the bacteria that had gone before, these new protists were wonders of design and sophistication. The simple amoeba, just one cell big and without any ambitions but to exist, contains 400 million bits of genetic information in its DNA. Enough, as Carl Sagan noted, to fill 80 books of 500 pages. Eventually, the eukaryotes learned an even more singular trick. It took a long time, a billion years or so, but it was a good one when they mastered it. They learned to form together into complex multicellular beings. Thanks to this innovation, big, complicated, visible entities like us were possible. Planet Earth was ready to move on to its next ambitious phase. But before we get too excited about that, it is worth remembering that the world, as we are about to see, still belongs to the very small. 20. Small World. It's probably not a good idea to take too personal an interest in your microbes. Louis Pasteur, the great French chemist and bacteriologist, became so preoccupied with them that he took to peering critically at every dish placed before him with a magnifying glass, a habit that presumably did not win him many repeat invitations to dinner. In fact, there is no point in trying to hide from your bacteria, for they are on and around you always, in numbers you can't conceive. If you are in good health and averagely diligent about hygiene, you will have a herd of about 1 trillion bacteria grazing on your fleshy plains, about 100,000 of them on every square centimeter of skin. They are there to dine off the 10 billion or so flakes of skin you shed every day, plus all the tasty oils and fortifying minerals that seep out from every pore and fissure. You are, for them, the ultimate food court, with the convenience of warmth and constant mobility thrown in. By way of thanks, they give you B.O. And those are just the bacteria that inhabit your skin. There are trillions more tucked away in your gut and nasal passages, clinging to your hair and eyelashes, swimming over the surface of your eyes, drilling through the enamel of your teeth. Your digestive system alone is host to more than 100 trillion microbes of at least 400 types. Some deal with sugars, some with starches, some attack other bacteria. A surprising number, like the ubiquitous intestinal spirochetes, have no detectable function at all. They just seem to like to be with you. Every human body consists of about 10 quadrillion cells, but about 100 quadrillion bacterial cells. They are, in short, a big part of us. From the bacteria's point of view, of course, we are a rather small part of them. Because we humans are big and clever enough to produce and utilize antibiotics and disinfectants, it is easy to convince ourselves that we have banished bacteria to the fringes of existence. Don't you believe it? Bacteria may not build cities or have interesting social lives, but they will be here when the sun explodes. This is their planet, and we are on it only because they allow us to be. Bacteria, never forget, got along for billions of years without us. We couldn't survive a day without them. They process our wastes and make them usable again. Without their diligent munching, nothing would rot. They purify our water and keep our soils productive. Bacteria synthesize vitamins in our gut, convert the things we eat into useful sugars and polysaccharides, and go to war on alien microbes that slip down our gullet. We depend totally on bacteria to pluck nitrogen from the air and convert it into useful nucleotides and amino acids for us. It is a prodigious and gratifying feat. As Margulis and Sagan note, to do the same thing industrially, as when making fertilizers, manufacturers must heat the source materials to 500 degrees centigrade and squeeze them to 300 times normal pressures. Bacteria do it all the time without fuss, and thank goodness, for no larger organism could survive without the nitrogen they pass on. Above all, microbes continue to provide us with the air we breathe and to keep the atmosphere stable. Microbes, including the modern versions of cyanobacteria, supply the greater part of the planet's breathable oxygen. Algae and other tiny organisms, bubbling away in the sea, blow out about 150 billion kilos of the stuff every year. And they are amazingly prolific. The more frantic among them can yield a new generation in less than 10 minutes. Clostridium perfringens, the disagreeable little organism that causes gangrene, can reproduce in 9 minutes. At such a rate, a single bacterium could theoretically produce more offspring in 2 days than there are protons in the universe. Given an adequate supply of nutrients, a single bacterial cell can generate 280,000 billion individuals in a single day, according to the Belgian biochemist and Nobel laureate Christian de Duve. In the same period, a human cell can just about manage a single division. About once every million divisions, they produce a mutant. Usually this is bad luck for the mutant. Change is always risky for an organism, but just occasionally, the new bacterium is endowed with some accidental advantage, such as the ability to elude or shrug off an attack of antibiotics. With this ability to evolve rapidly goes another, even scarier advantage. Bacteria share information. Any bacterium can take pieces of genetic coding from any other. Essentially, as Margulis and Sagan put it, all bacteria swim in a single gene pool. Any adaptive change that occurs in one area of the bacterial universe can spread to any other. It's rather as if a human could go to an insect to get the necessary genetic coding to sprout wings or walk on ceilings. It means that, from a genetic point of view, bacteria have become a single superorganism. Tiny, dispersed, but invincible. They will live and thrive on almost anything you spill, dribble, or shake loose. Just give them a little moisture, as when you run a damp cloth over a counter, and they will bloom as if created from nothing. They will eat wood, the glue in wallpaper, the metals in hardened paint. Scientists in Australia found microbes known as Thiobacillus concretivorans that lived in, indeed could not live without, concentrations of sulfuric acid strong enough to dissolve metal. A species called Micrococcus radiophilus was found living happily in the waste tanks of nuclear reactors, gorging itself on plutonium and whatever else was there. Some bacteria break down chemical materials from which, as far as we can tell, they gain no benefit at all. They have been found living in boiling mud pots and lakes of caustic soda, deep inside rocks, at the bottom of the sea, in hidden pools of icy water in the McMurdo dry valleys of Antarctica, and 7 miles down in the Pacific Ocean, where pressures are more than 1,000 times greater than at the surface, or equivalent to being squashed beneath 50 jumbo jets. Some of them seem to be practically indestructible. Deinococcus radiodurans is, according to The Economist, almost immune to radioactivity. Blast its DNA with radiation and the pieces immediately reform, like the scuttling limbs of an undead creature from a horror movie. Perhaps the most extraordinary survival yet found was that of a streptococcus bacterium that was recovered from the sealed lens of a camera that had stood on the moon for 2 years. In short, there are few environments in which bacteria aren't prepared to live. They are finding now that when they push probes into ocean vents so hot that the probes actually start to melt, there are bacteria even there, Victoria Bennett told me. In the 1920s, two scientists at the University of Chicago, Edson Baston and Frank Greer, announced that they had isolated from oil wells strains of bacteria that had been living at depths of 2,000 feet. The notion was dismissed as fundamentally preposterous. There was nothing to live on at 2,000 feet, and for 50 years it was assumed that their samples had been contaminated with surface microbes. We now know that there are a lot of microbes living deep within the earth, many of which have nothing at all to do with the organic world. They eat rocks, or rather, the stuff that's in rocks, iron, sulfur, manganese, and so on. And they breathe odd things too, iron, chromium, cobalt, even uranium. Such processes may be instrumental in concentrating gold, copper, and other precious metals, and possibly deposits of oil and natural gas. It has even been suggested that their tireless nibblings created the Earth's crust. Some scientists now think that there could be as much as 100 trillion tons of bacteria living beneath our feet in what are known as subsurface lithoautotrophic microbial ecosystems, slime for short. Thomas Gold of Cornell has estimated that if you took all the bacteria out of the Earth's interior and dumped it on the surface, it would cover the planet to a depth of 5 feet. If the estimates are correct, there could be more life under the Earth than on top of it. At depth, microbes shrink in size and become extremely sluggish. The liveliest of them may divide no more than once a century, some no more than perhaps once in 500 years. As The Economist has put it, the key to long life, it seems, is not to do too much. When things are really tough, bacteria are prepared to shut down all systems and wait for better times. In 1997, scientists successfully activated some anthrax spores that had lain dormant for 80 years in a museum display in Trondheim, Norway. Other microorganisms have leapt back to life after being released from a 118-year-old can of meat and a 166-year-old bottle of beer. In 1996, scientists at the Russian Academy of Science claimed to have revived bacteria frozen in Siberian permafrost for 3 million years. But the record claim for durability so far is one made by Russell Vreeland and colleagues at Westchester University in Pennsylvania in 2000, when they announced that they had resuscitated 250 million-year-old bacteria called Bacillus permians that had been trapped in salt deposits 2,000 feet underground in Carlsbad, New Mexico. If so, this microbe is older than the continents. The report met with some understandable dubiousness. Many biochemists maintained that over such a span, the microbe's components would have become uselessly degraded unless the bacterium roused itself from time to time. However, if the bacterium did stir occasionally, there was no plausible internal source of energy that could have lasted so long. The more doubtful scientists suggested that the sample may have been contaminated, if not during its retrieval, then perhaps while still buried. In 2001, a team from Tel Aviv University argued that B. permians were almost identical to a strain of modern bacteria, Bacillus marismortui, found in the Dead Sea. Only two of its genetic sequences differed, and then only slightly. Are we to believe, the Israeli researchers wrote, that in 250 million years, B. permians has accumulated the same amount of genetic differences that could be achieved in just 3 to 7 days in the laboratory? In reply, Vreeland suggested that bacteria evolve faster in the lab than they do in the wild. Maybe. It is a remarkable fact that well into the space age, most school textbooks divided the world of the living into just two categories, plant and animal. microorganisms hardly featured. Amoebas and similar single-celled organisms were treated as proto-animals and algae as proto-plants. Bacteria were usually lumped in with plants too, even though everyone knew they didn't belong there. As far back as the late 19th century, the German naturalist Ernst Haeckel had suggested that bacteria deserved to be placed in a separate kingdom, which he called Monera. But the idea didn't begin to catch on among biologists until the 1960s, and then only among some of them. I note that my trusty American Heritage Desk Dictionary from 1969 doesn't recognize the term. Many organisms in the visible world were also poorly served by the traditional division. Fungi, the group that includes mushrooms, molds, mildews, yeasts, and puffballs, were nearly always treated as botanical objects, though in fact almost nothing about them, how they reproduce and respire, how they build themselves, matches anything in the plant world. Structurally, they have more in common with animals in that they build their cells from chitin, a material that gives them their distinctive texture. The same substance is used to make the shells of insects and the claws of mammals, though it isn't nearly so tasty in a stag beetle as in a portobello mushroom. Above all, unlike all plants, fungi don't photosynthesize, so they have no chlorophyll and thus are not green. Instead, they grow directly on their food source, which can be almost anything. Fungi will eat the sulfur of a concrete wall, or the decaying matter between your toes, two things no plant will do. Almost the only plant-like quality they have is that they root. Even less comfortably susceptible to categorization was the peculiar group of organisms formerly called Myxomycetes, but more commonly known as slime molds. The name, no doubt, has much to do with their obscurity. An appellation that sounded a little more dynamic, ambulant, self-activating protoplasm, say, and less like the stuff you find when you reach deep into a clogged drain, would almost certainly have earned these extraordinary entities a more immediate share of the attention they deserve, for slime molds are, make no mistake, among the most interesting organisms in nature. When times are good, they exist as one-celled individuals, much like amoebas. But when conditions grow tough, they crawl to a central gathering place and become, almost miraculously, a slug. The slug is not a thing of beauty, and it doesn't go terribly far, usually just from the bottom of a pile of leaf litter to the top, where it is in a slightly more exposed position. But for millions of years this may well have been the niftiest trick in the universe. And it doesn't stop there. Having hauled itself up to a more favourable locale, the slime mould transforms itself yet again, taking on the form of a plant. By some curious, orderly process, the cells reconfigure, like the members of a tiny marching band, to make a stalk, atop of which forms a bulb known as a fruiting body. Inside the fruiting body are millions of spores that, at the appropriate moment, are released to the wind to blow away and become single-celled organisms that can start the process again. For years, slime molds were claimed as protozoa by zoologists and as fungi by mycologists, though most people could see they didn't really belong anywhere. When genetic testing arrived, people in lab coats were surprised to find that slime molds were so distinctive and peculiar that they weren't directly related to anything else in nature, and sometimes not even to each other. In 1969, in an attempt to bring some order to the growing inadequacies of classification, an ecologist from Cornell University named R. H. Whittaker unveiled in the journal Science a proposal to divide life into five principal branches, kingdoms, as they are known, called Animalia, Plantae, Fungi, Protista, and Monera. Protista was a modification of an earlier term, Protoctista, which had been suggested a century earlier by a Scottish biologist named John Hogg, and was meant to describe any organism that was neither plant nor animal. Though Whittaker's new scheme was a great improvement, Protista remained ill-defined. Some taxonomists reserved it for large unicellular organisms, the eukaryotes, but others treated it as the kind of odd sock drawer of biology, putting into it anything that didn't fit anywhere else. It included, depending on which text you consulted, slime molds, amoebas, and even seaweed, among much else. By one calculation, it contained as many as 200,000 different species of organism all told. That's a lot of odd socks. Ironically, just as Whittaker's five-kingdom classification was beginning to find its way into textbooks, a retiring academic at the University of Illinois was groping his way toward a discovery that would challenge everything. His name was Carl Woese, and since the mid-1960s, or about as early as it was possible to do so, he had been quietly studying genetic sequences in bacteria. In the early days, this was an exceedingly painstaking process. Work on a single bacterium could easily consume a year. At that time, according to Woese, only about 500 species of bacteria were known, which is fewer than the number of species you have in your mouth. Today, the number is about 10 times that, though that is still far short of the 26,900 species of algae, 70,000 of fungi, and 30,800 of amoebas and related organisms whose biographies fill the annals of biology. It isn't simple indifference that keeps the total low. Bacteria can be exasperatingly difficult to isolate and study. Only about 1% will grow in culture. Considering how wildly adaptable they are in nature, it is an odd fact that the one place they seem not to wish to live is a petri dish. Plop them on a bed of agar and pamper them as you will, and most will just lie there, declining every inducement to bloom. Any bacterium that thrives in a lab is by definition exceptional, and yet these were, almost exclusively, the organisms studied by microbiologists. It was, said Woese, like learning about animals from visiting zoos. Genes, however, allowed Woese to approach microorganisms from another angle. As he worked, Woese realized that there were more fundamental divisions in the microbial world than anyone suspected. A lot of little organisms that looked like bacteria and behaved like bacteria were actually something else altogether, something that had branched off from bacteria a long time ago. Woese called these organisms archaebacteria, later shortened to archaea. It has to be said that the attributes that distinguish archaea from bacteria are not the sort that would quicken the pulse of any but a biologist. They are mostly differences in their lipids and an absence of something called peptidoglycan. But in practice, they make a world of difference. Archaeans are more different from bacteria than you and I are from a crab or spider. Single-handedly, Woese had discovered an unsuspected division of life, so fundamental that it stood above the level of kingdom at the apogee of the universal tree of life, as it is rather reverentially known. In 1976, he startled the world, or at least a little bit of it that was paying attention, by redrawing the tree of life to incorporate not 5 main divisions, but 23. These he grouped under 3 new principal categories, bacteria, archaea, and eukarya, which he called domains. Woese's new divisions did not take the biological world by storm. Some dismissed them as much too heavily weighted toward the microbial. Many just ignored them. Woese, according to Francis Ashcroft, felt bitterly disappointed. But slowly his new scheme began to catch on among microbiologists. Botanists and zoologists were much slower to admire its virtues. It's not hard to see why. On Woese's model, the worlds of botany and zoology are relegated to a few twigs on the outermost branch of the eukaryan limb. Everything else belongs to unicellular beings. These folks were brought up to classify in terms of gross morphological similarities and differences, Woese told an interviewer in 1996. The idea of doing so in terms of molecular sequence is a bit hard for many of them to swallow. In short, if they couldn't see a difference with their own eyes, they didn't like it. And so they persisted with a traditional five-kingdom division, an arrangement that Woese called not very useful in his milder moments and positively misleading much of the rest of the time. Biology, like physics before it, Woese wrote, has moved to a level where the objects of interest and their interactions often cannot be perceived through direct observation. In 1998, the great and ancient Harvard zoologist Ernst Mayr, who then was in his 94th year and at the time of my writing is nearly 100 and still going strong, stirred the pot further by declaring that there should be just 2 prime divisions of life. Empires, he called them. In a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Mayer said that Woese's findings were interesting but ultimately misguided, noting that Woese was not trained as a biologist and quite naturally does not have an extensive familiarity with the principles of classification, which is perhaps as close as one distinguished scientist can come to saying of another that he doesn't know what he is talking about. The specifics of Mayer's criticisms are too technical to need extensive airing here. They involve issues of meiotic sexuality, Hennigian cladification, and controversial interpretations of the genome of Methanobacterium thermoautrophicum, among rather a lot else. But essentially he argues that Woese's arrangement unbalances the tree of life. The bacterial realm, Mayer notes, consists of no more than a few thousand species, while the Archaean has a mere 175 named specimens, with perhaps a few thousand more to be found, but hardly more than that. By contrast, the eukaryotic realm, that is, the complicated organisms with nucleated cells, like us, numbers already in the millions. For the sake of the principle of balance, Mayer argues for combining the simple bacterial organisms into a single category, prokaryota, while placing the more complex and highly evolved remainder in the empire eukaryota, which would stand alongside as an equal. Put another way, he argues for keeping things much as they were before. This division between simple cells and complex cells is where the great break is in the living world. The distinction between halophilic Archaeans and Methanosarcina, or between flavobacteria and gram-positive bacteria, clearly will never be a matter of moment for most of us, but it is worth remembering that each is as different from its neighbours as animals are from plants. If Woese's new arrangement teaches us anything, it is that life really is various, and that most of that variety is small, unicellular, and unfamiliar. It is a natural human impulse to think of evolution as a long chain of improvements, of a never-ending advance toward largeness and complexity, in a word, toward us. We flatter ourselves. Most of the real diversity in evolution has been small scale. We large things are just flukes, an interesting side branch. Of the 23 main divisions of life, only 3, plants, animals, and fungi, are large enough to be seen by the human eye. And even they contain species that are microscopic. Indeed, according to Woese, if you totaled up all the biomass of the planet, every living thing, plants included, microbes would account for at least 80% of all there is. Perhaps more. The world belongs to the very small, and it has for a very long time. So why, you are bound to ask at some point in your life, do microbes so often want to hurt us? What possible satisfaction could there be to a microbe in having us grow feverish or chilled or disfigured with sores or, above all, expire? A dead host, after all, is hardly going to provide long-term hospitality. To begin with, it is worth remembering that most microorganisms are neutral or even beneficial to human well-being. The most rampantly infectious organism on Earth, a bacterium called Wolbachia, doesn't hurt humans at all, or, come to that, any other vertebrates. But if you are a shrimp, or worm, or fruit fly, it can make you wish you had never been born. Altogether, only about 1 microbe in 1,000 is a pathogen for humans, according to National Geographic. Though knowing what some of them can do, we could be forgiven for thinking that that is quite enough. Even if mostly benign, microbes are still the number 3 killer in the Western world, and even many less lethal ones, of course, make us deeply rue their existence. Making a host unwell has certain benefits for the microbe. The symptoms of an illness often help to spread the disease. Vomiting, sneezing, and diarrhea are excellent methods of getting out of one host and into position for another. The most effective strategy of all is to enlist the help of a mobile third party. Infectious organisms love mosquitoes because the mosquito's sting delivers them directly to a bloodstream where they can get straight to work before the victim's defense mechanisms can figure out what's hit them. This is why so many grade A diseases, malaria, yellow fever, dengue fever, encephalitis, and 100 or so other less celebrated but often rapacious maladies begin with a mosquito bite. It is a fortunate fluke for us that HIV, the AIDS agent, isn't among them. At least, not yet. Any HIV the mosquito sucks up on its travels is dissolved by the mosquito's own metabolism. When the day comes that the virus mutates its way around this, we may be in real trouble. It is a mistake, however, to consider the matter too carefully from the position of logic, because microorganisms clearly are not calculating entities. They don't care what they do to you any more than you care what distress you cause when you slaughter them by the millions with a soapy shower or a swipe of deodorant. The only time your continuing well-being is of consequence to a pathogen is when it kills you too well. If they eliminate you before they can move on, then they may well die out themselves. This, in fact, sometimes happens. History, Jared Diamond notes, is full of diseases that once caused terrifying epidemics and then disappeared as mysteriously as they had come. He cites the robust but mercifully transient English sweating sickness, which raged from 1485 to 1552, killing tens of thousands as it went before burning itself out. Too much efficiency is not a good thing for any infectious organism. A great deal of sickness arises not because of what the organism has done to you, but what your body is trying to do to the organism. In its quest to rid the body of pathogens, the immune system sometimes destroys cells or damages critical tissues. So often, when you are unwell, what you are feeling is not the pathogens, but your own immune responses. Anyway, getting sick is a sensible response to infection. Sick people retire to their beds, and thus are less of a threat to the wider community. Resting also frees more of the body's resources to attend to the infection. Because there are so many things out there with the potential to hurt you, your body holds lots of different varieties of defensive white cells, some 10 million types in all, each designed to identify and destroy a particular sort of invader. It would be impossibly inefficient to maintain 10 million separate standing armies, so each variety of white cell keeps only a few scouts on active duty. When an infectious agent, what's known as an antigen, invades, relevant scouts identify the attacker and put out a call for reinforcements of the right type. While your body is manufacturing these forces, you are likely to feel wretched. The onset of recovery begins when the troops finally swing into action. White cells are merciless and will hunt down and kill every last pathogen they can find. To avoid extinction, attackers have evolved two elemental strategies. Either they strike quickly and move on to a new host, as with common infectious illnesses like flu, or they disguise themselves so that the white cells fail to spot them, as with HIV, the virus responsible for AIDS, which can sit harmlessly and unnoticed in the nuclei of cells for years before springing into action. One of the odder aspects of infection is that microbes that normally do no harm at all sometimes get into the wrong parts of the body and go kind of crazy, in the words of Dr. Brian Marsh, an infectious diseases specialist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire. It happens all the time with car accidents when people suffer internal injuries. Microbes that are normally benign in the gut get into other parts of the body, the bloodstream, for instance, and cause terrible havoc. The scariest, most out-of-control bacterial disorder of the moment is a disease called necrotizing fasciitis, in which bacteria essentially eat the victim from the inside out, devouring internal tissue and leaving behind a pulpy, noxious residue. Patients often come in with comparatively mild complaints, a skin rash and fever, typically, but then dramatically deteriorate. When they are opened up, it is often found that they are simply being consumed. The only treatment is what is known as radical excisional surgery, cutting out every bit of infected area. 70% of victims die. Many of the rest are left terribly disfigured. The source of the infection is a mundane family of bacteria called Group A Streptococcus, which normally do no more than cause strep throat. Very occasionally, for reasons unknown, some of these bacteria get through the lining of the throat and into the body proper, where they wreak the most devastating havoc. They are completely resistant to antibiotics. About 1,000 cases a year occur in the United States, and no one can say that it won't get worse. Precisely the same thing happens with meningitis. At least 10% of young adults and perhaps 30% of teenagers carry the deadly meningococcal bacterium, but it lives quite harmlessly in the throat. just occasionally, in about one young person in 100,000, it gets into the bloodstream and makes them very ill indeed. In the worst cases, death can come in 12 hours. That's shockingly quick. "You can have a person who's in perfect health at breakfast and dead by evening," says Marsh. We would have much more success with bacteria if we weren't so profligate with our best weapon against them, antibiotics. Remarkably, by one estimate, some 70% of the antibiotics used in the developed world are given to farm animals, often routinely in stock feed, simply to promote growth or as a precaution against infection. Such applications give bacteria every opportunity to evolve a resistance to them. It is an opportunity that they have enthusiastically seized. In 1952, penicillin was fully effective against all strains of Staphylococcus bacteria, to such an extent that by the early 1960s, the U.S. Surgeon General William Stewart felt confident enough to declare, "The time has come to close the book on infectious diseases. We have basically wiped out infection in the United States." Even as he spoke, however, some 90% of those strains were in the process of developing immunity to penicillin. Soon, one of these new strains, called methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, began to show up in hospitals. Only one type of antibiotic, vancomycin, remained effective against it. But in 1997, a hospital in Tokyo reported the appearance of a strain that could resist even that. Within months, it had spread to 6 other Japanese hospitals. All over, the microbes are beginning to win the war again. In U.S. hospitals alone, some 14,000 people a year die from infections they pick up there. As James Surowiecki has noted, given a choice between developing antibiotics that people will take every day for 2 weeks, or antidepressants that people will take every day forever, drug companies not surprisingly opt for the latter. Although a few antibiotics have been toughened up a bit, the pharmaceutical industry hasn't given us an entirely new antibiotic since the 1970s. Our carelessness is all the more alarming since the discovery that many other ailments may be bacterial in origin. The process of discovery began in 1983, when Barry Marshall, a doctor in Perth, Western Australia, found that many stomach cancers and most stomach ulcers are caused by a bacterium called Helicobacter pylori. Even though his findings were easily tested, the notion was so radical that more than a decade would pass before they were generally accepted. America's National Institutes of Health, for instance, didn't officially endorse the idea until 1994. Hundreds, even thousands of people must have died from ulcers who wouldn't have, Marshall told a reporter from Forbes in 1999. Since then, further research has shown that there is, or may well be, a bacterial component in all kinds of other disorders. Heart disease, asthma, arthritis, multiple sclerosis, several types of mental disorders, many cancers, even, it has been suggested, in science no less, obesity. The day may not be far off when we desperately require an effective antibiotic and haven't got one to call on. It may come as a slight comfort to know that bacteria can themselves get sick. They are sometimes infected by bacteriophages, or simply phages, a type of virus. A virus is a strange and unlovely entity, a piece of nucleic acid surrounded by bad news, in the memorable phrase of the Nobel laureate Peter Medawar. Smaller and simpler than bacteria, viruses aren't themselves alive. In isolation, they are inert and harmless. But introduce them into a suitable host, and they burst into business, into life. About 5,000 types of virus are known, and between them they afflict us with many hundreds of diseases, ranging from the flu and common cold to those that are most invidious to human well-being: smallpox, rabies, yellow fever, Ebola, polio, and the human immunodeficiency virus, the source of AIDS. Viruses prosper by hijacking the genetic material of a living cell and using it to produce more virus. They reproduce in a fanatical manner, then burst out in search of more cells to invade. Not being living organisms themselves, they can afford to be very simple. Many, including HIV, have 10 genes or fewer, whereas even the simplest bacteria require several thousand. They are also very tiny, much too small to be seen with a conventional microscope. It wasn't until 1943 and the invention of the electron microscope that science got its first look at them. But they can do immense damage. Smallpox in the 20th century alone killed an estimated 300 million people. They also have an unnerving capacity to burst upon the world in some new and startling form, and then to vanish again as quickly as they came. In 1916, in one such case, people in Europe and America began to come down with a strange sleeping sickness, which became known as encephalitis lethargica. Victims would go to sleep and not wake up. They could be roused without great difficulty to take food or go to the lavatory, and would answer questions sensibly. They knew who and where they were, though their manner was always apathetic. However, the moment they were permitted to rest, they would sink at once back into deepest slumber, and remain in that state for as long as they were left. Some went on in this manner for months before dying. A very few survived and regained consciousness, but not their former liveliness. They existed in a state of profound apathy, like extinct volcanoes, in the words of one doctor. In 10 years the disease killed some 5 million people, and then quietly went away. It didn't get much lasting attention because in the meantime, an even worse epidemic, indeed the worst in history, swept across the world. It is sometimes called the Great Swine Flu Epidemic and sometimes the Great Spanish Flu Epidemic, but in either case it was ferocious. World War I killed 21 million people in 4 years. Swine flu did the same in its first 4 months. Almost 80% of American casualties in the First World War came not from enemy fire, but from flu. In some units, the mortality rate was as high as 80%. Swine flu arose as a normal, non-lethal flu in the spring of 1918, but somehow, over the following months, no one knows how or where, it mutated into something more severe. A fifth of victims suffered only mild symptoms, but the rest became gravely ill and often died. Some succumbed within hours. Others held on for a few days. In the United States, the first deaths were recorded among sailors in Boston in late August 1918, but the epidemic quickly spread to all parts of the country. Schools closed, public entertainments were shut down, people everywhere wore masks. It did little good. Between the autumn of 1918 and spring of the following year, 548,452 people died of the flu in America. The toll in Britain was 220,000, with similar numbers dead in France and Germany. No one knows the global toll, as records in the Third World were often poor, but it was not less than 20 million, and probably more like 50 million. Some estimates have put the global total as high as 100 million. In an attempt to devise a vaccine, medical authorities conducted tests on volunteers at a military prison on Deer Island in Boston Harbor. The prisoners were promised pardons if they survived a battery of tests. These tests were rigorous, to say the least. First, the subjects were injected with infected lung tissue taken from the dead, and then sprayed in the eyes, nose, and mouth with infectious aerosols. If they still failed to succumb, they had their throats swabbed with discharges taken from the sick and dying. If all else failed, they were required to sit open-mouthed while a gravely ill victim was helped to cough into their faces. Out of, somewhat amazingly, 300 men who volunteered, the doctors chose 62 for the tests. None contracted the flu. Not one. The only person who did grow ill was the ward doctor, who swiftly died. The probable explanation for this is that the epidemic had passed through the prison a few weeks earlier, and the volunteers, all of whom had survived that visitation, had natural immunity. Much about the 1918 flu is understood poorly or not at all. One mystery is how it erupted suddenly, all over, in places separated by oceans, mountain ranges, and other earthly impediments. A virus can survive for no more than a few hours outside a host body, so how could it appear in Madrid, Bombay, and Philadelphia all in the same week? The probable answer is that it was incubated and spread by people who had only slight symptoms or none at all. Even in normal outbreaks, about 10% of people have the flu, but are unaware of it because they experience no ill effects. And because they remain in circulation, they tend to be the great spreaders of the disease. That would account for the 1918 outbreak's widespread distribution, but it still doesn't explain how it managed to lay low for several months before erupting so explosively at more or less the same time all over. Even more mysterious is that it was primarily devastating to people